Hello and welcome to the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs podcast focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, the host of the Majlis podcast and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager for South and Central Asia here in Washington, D.C. In times of crisis like the one we are currently facing with the global pandemic of COVID-19, people's health depends at minimum on free access to timely and accurate information. As the world is grappling with the spread of the infection, some leaders are not only censoring criticism, but also using the lockdown aimed to curb the virus as an opportunity for power grabbing. That includes further restrictions on freedom of the press, passing of laws which would normally cause uproar and fight back, and some staging massive events putting their politics above the public health. By now, it is an open secret on how the Chinese government illustrated the disastrous consequences of ignoring that reality, but now these tendencies are emerging closer to home, some in Central Asia. In today's Majlis podcast, in the light of these developments, we are here to discuss what some of the Central Asian leaders and governments have been doing lately and what their actions tell us. To discuss all these, I'm joined by Dr. Erica Marat, Associate Professor at the National Defense University and the author of The Politics of Police Reform, who's originally from Kyrgyzstan, Dr. Edward Lemon, Assistant Professor at the Daniel Morgan Graduate School, Farouk Yusupi, the Director of RFL's Turkmen Service, and Bruce Spanier, the Editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia Blog, Kishlok Owozi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today. To start with a serious note, we have been seeing some rather bizarre and strange developments in the times of crisis. Earlier, Tajikistan organized a massive Nowruz party. Later, Turkmenistan stepped up this even further by staging nationwide events, ironically aimed to propagate healthy life, now apparently preparing for another massive multiple-day event, which usually brings hundreds of students into the stadiums. Now, first, let's recall, Edward, those events in Tajikistan, and then your analysis on why they did what they did. Is there any connection to what we are talking about today in terms of political calculation, politics above the public health, and political power grabbing there?
Sure. Well, I think the Tajik approach has been a strategy of denial. As you said, Nowruz celebrations at the end of March went ahead unchanged. The football season kicked off last week without a crowd, but the teams are still playing. Schools are still open, and there have been very little sort of restrictions on mobility within the country. The Tajik government, of course, presents itself as ready to fight coronavirus. It says it's imported 27,000 tests and already quarantined over 6,000 people. And there was a case earlier this week where a 60-year-old man died in the north of the country. And as a result, they quarantined 13 of the staff and relatives. Obviously, this is sort of an alarming development, but the government's denied that that had any link to coronavirus, saying that he died of pneumonia. So it's a strategy of denial, but obviously there are a number of reasons to think that it's almost impossible for Tajikistan not to have coronavirus. Obviously, with the degree of trade with China, migration with Russia, the fact that the government historically has a very poor track record on lying, and those two media outlets that have been covering sort of the potential outbreak in the north of the country, Akhbar and Radio Free Europe's Tajik service, have both come under a lot of pressure from the government.
Right.
Had their websites blocked, and this week Akhbar being declared an extremist outlet and being banned by the Supreme Court. So, you know, there are a number of reasons to think that it's highly unlikely that Tajikistan has no coronavirus at this point.
Edward, what role politics has been playing in what they do and how they do it?
Well, I think the government wants to present itself as being in control. I think this is, you know, there's a number of reasons to think that this could be a destabilizing moment for Tajikistan. You know, not only does it have to sort of potentially reckon with a coronavirus outbreak in a country that has the worst public health system in the former Soviet Union, the country that has only budgeted $22 per person a year within its medical budget this year. You know, it's the lowest in the former Soviet Union, one of the lowest in the world on comparison with sort of sub-Saharan Africa. So it's ill-equipped to deal with this outbreak, coupled with that, obviously, a country that's 30% of its economy is based on migration, with migrants unable to enter Russia at this point, a time when it would have been the most busy period for migration. We're going to obviously have the exogenous shock of the downturn in the Russian economy and the downturn in remittances that's going to cause Tajikistan to have major problems going forward. So I think, you know, I don't know if there's any strategy for the government, but at this point, they've opted for denial. The narrative that everything is fine, everything's going to be fine. Tajikistan is a unique country that can buffer itself against this against this global crisis. But obviously, this is unlikely to happen, to say the least.
Right. Farooq, the same happened in Turkmenistan in terms of the massive events. Tell us about those events of this week and the event that's coming up. I guess they are going to restart, in fact, the football league that they were planning.
Yeah, it's Turkmenistan. You know, Turkmenistan is in permanent denial of the outside world. Whatever crisis happens around the world and in the region, Turkmenistan is not worried, because we know that Turkmenistan officially lives in the era of happiness and might. Until last Friday, it was ever mentioned, the coronavirus, and all of a sudden, President Berdimuhamedov decided to devote the government meeting to discussing the impact of coronavirus to the world economy. And the world economy, of course, would somehow impact Turkmenistan, but Turkmenistan is very much ready to counter any downturns. And after that, they still went ahead and had this bizarre event when they gathered 7,000 people around the country to do this bicycle ride. Why 7,000? We all know that 7 is the favorite number of the Turkmen president. The number 7 brings him luck. But I mean, they did this event, unlike these 7,000 people who were congregated together, President Berdimuhamedov himself was smart enough to isolate and be riding on bicycle with his son only. I mean, he realizes that this is a very serious problem, because I mean, he has a medical background. But because of that medical background, and because the health is something like a big part of his national ideology or his cult of personality, he never ever will admit that coronavirus ever penetrated Turkmenistan. He himself would see it as a big failure on his part.
Yeah, I remember in my days back in the Turkmen service, him speaking about TB, tuberculosis. His exact words were like, "We don't have TB patients in the country, and it could not even come to Turkmenistan." The other fact is that it is anyway extremely challenging to report from Turkmenistan in ordinary days. How has this affected your local reporters' ability to send information from Turkmenistan? How is this crisis and the measures that the authorities might be taking, how has they affected to?
I will give you one example. I asked my colleagues in Turkmenistan not to write word coronavirus, because people were getting arrested just for discussing. I mean, despite president already pronounced the word, uttered the word, they still having meetings in the mornings, these public organizations, and warning the employees against discussing coronavirus, because it officially does not exist in Turkmenistan. And I asked my colleagues just to be on the safe side, not to write that word, because we know that Turkmen secret services or security services, they have the sophisticated equipment that can trace certain words. They can trace whoever uses VPN. And in Turkmenistan, they, whenever they want, within a second, they can slow down internet or shut it off completely in any region. Yeah, it has become more complicated, because it takes us longer to verify any information that we receive, because we cannot rely on one correspondent. It's a very tricky situation in Turkmenistan. So we have to verify it with second and third correspondent, and it takes us very long. Like, for example, last week, it took us 2 days to verify one information about this small food riot that took place in Mari region.
Right.
So it has become more complicated, but I mean, it has been always complicated in usual days too.
Yeah, we are talking about Turkmenistan and Tajikistan, Erica, but there are a lot to talk about Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan too. I will come to you shortly. Here, let me bring Bruce you in here. Earlier, we were talking about, Bruce, about the authorities' decision in Tajikistan to deny accreditation for our Tajik services bureau chief, and I think also it included the admin of the bureau. So on one hand, the authorities say that, okay, we don't have any Kuwait, or maybe they don't care what Kuwait is about. On the other hand, you are seeing this sort of a crackdown against the journalists. How you reconcile these two?
Well, I mean, the Tajik services problems are a long-running story.
Right.
This just happens to be one of those moments where the Tajik government has a few extra tools it can use to crack down a little bit, put some pressure on even us. The accreditations haven't been approved, but I would imagine the Tajik government would probably respond right now, would respond to that by saying we have more important things to worry about than accreditation for a few reporters. Certainly they don't want, it was mentioned already that part of the problem is that Azadi, like Akbar, will report about information that suggests that the virus is in the country. And as Edward mentioned, the government, this runs absolutely counter to what the government is saying. So they don't want to hear that at all. So, our people are unlikely to get accredited as long as this crisis is going on, I'm sure. That the Tajik government, like I said, will probably just say we're busy and we can't get to it. But in fact, it serves their purposes that this is on because it gives them an excuse not to give the people accreditation. If they did have accreditation, we would be out there asking people what they've heard. Is some village quarantined like supposedly there are in the north? What's happening in the country? So
Yeah. Now, aside from the freedom of the press, the lockdown also gives an opportunity for leaders a legal sort of tool to prevent any exercise of discontent on decisions they might be taking using this crisis as an opportunity. So while Tajikistan and Turkmenistan has its own set of serious problems, as I said a little bit earlier, there is also a lot to talk about the rest of countries in Central Asia. Let's continue the discussion talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast. I'm joined by Dr. Erica Marat, Associate Professor at the National Defense University and the author of The Politics of Police Reform, Dr. Edward Lemon, Assistant Professor at the Daniel Morgan Graduate School, Faruk Yusupi, the Director of RFURL's Turkmen Service, Bruce Panier, the Editor of Ready for Europe, Ready Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Awazi. I'm Mohamed Tahir, Ready for Europe, Ready Liberty's Media Manager for South and Central Asia here in Washington, D.C., and we are discussing politics and COVID-19 in Central Asia. So about Kazakhstan, Erica, yes, they are taking measures similar to what we have seen around the world in terms of the testing, in terms of reporting cases, in taking preventive measures like the lockdown. But these are not the only measures they are taking involving COVID-19. So tell us, please, as a Kazakhstan watcher, where our eyes should be, what they are doing and why they are doing it.
I think the countries that admit that they have coronavirus cases and taking active measures, so Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Uzbekistan, are really leveraging law enforcement systems that have been in place before the crisis. In Kazakhstan's case, it's sophisticated surveillance technologies in urban areas that are able to monitor the movement of people through even facial recognition technologies. Kazakh authorities use drones to see who is out, who is violating state regulations. In Uzbekistan, those are large police contingents that are now being redeployed across the country and control movement of population. And in Kyrgyzstan, it's a sort of hodgepodge of different measures, some police, but also reinforcement of this Institute of Registry, Propiska, so of, the residence registry for population, and then different oblasts are coming up with their own ways of monitoring who is coming in and coming out. But across those three countries, one tendency is similar, both in countries like Kyrgyzstan, where there is more freedom of speech, and countries like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, where there are fewer independent voices, is that the medical personnel are being, their voices are being suppressed, and medical personnel who face huge risks and lack of protective equipment, being infected, and sometimes the reports leak on social media. For instance, there was a recent report of a doctor in Taraz in Kazakhstan or in Jalalabad in Kyrgyzstan. But those reports are being suppressed, and authorities are acting very aggressively against medical personnel to prevent this kind of complaints reaching reaching the public and trying to present this idea that the authorities are controlling the situation.
Bruce, also, we have been witnessing lately in terms of the authorities taking the advantage of COVID-19 for their own political gains. It looks like while they are locking down cities, especially I'm talking about Kazakhstan here, Parliament has been busy with taking some urgent, maybe some not very urgent matters. What are they doing and what we should be looking at what they are doing between the lines?
The lower house of Kazakhstan's parliament has been going through the readings of the new law on public meetings and gatherings. And, you know, and a lot of people have complained about that. In fact, the second reading passed just a couple of days ago. And people are complaining that the parliament should probably have something more important to do than this. But in the meantime, there have been numerous complaints about this. One, because some of the deputies are in quarantine and the government says that they are in touch via video link and telephone with these deputies who are quarantined at home. But, you know, who knows exactly what's going on? And people who are opposed to this are limited to being able to express their opposition to the law only really on social networks. Kazakhstan has been developing a more vibrant protest culture. It's often very small. It could be one person. But those people are denied the chance to go out on the street at this moment and protest, you know, passage of this law, which a lot of people don't agree with. It gives them the right to protest, you know, in a nutshell. There's certain locations they have to go to do it. And the number of people who can participate is limited. I think it's only 250 or something, you know. So, but if you're against the law, like I said, there's not much you can do. Parliament's meeting and going right ahead with it. And just I'll mention as a note, because it's an advertisement for our Tajik service, that the Tajik government today just passed a rule that you have to register your mobile phone, smartphone, iPad, or notebooks, computers with the international identification code at the common unified registrar with the government, you know. And so this is a new rule that you just put in, too. Well, you know, and what can you do about it? But, you know, Kazakhstan's case probably more public, more publicized, and certainly more drawn out. But, you know, they're not the only ones that they're coming up with these new rules all of a sudden. And there's really not much the population can do about it, you know, because it's practically martial law across the region.
Yeah. And we were earlier talking about also, Bruce, maybe you would like to ask this question to Erica about the smart city and facial recognition. I think Erica also just touched upon that. What was the question? I kind of forgot that Erica's here, so let's ask her.
Yeah, well, I was just saying that I know Erica knows far more about this than I do, but I'd heard in Kazakhstan, for instance, they're using the CCTV to monitor drivers and license plates, you know, one, to check and see if this person has permission to be out. And they do that with people that are walking around the city, too. You know, Erica mentioned they got drones out and stuff like that. But, you know, it's like practice for controlling the population, you know. And like I said, that was kind of creepy to think that they're following your car down the road and tagging your license plate and running all the information to see what you do and do you have the right to go out on the street. And then, of course, you have to register in all Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan. If you want to go out, everyone else is locked down, then you have to get special permission to do that, too. There's all kinds of problems with permission. It applies to journalists, for instance. We're complaining in Kyrgyzstan because it's unclear. You know, they got a commandant, which is kind of spooky to think about, and he appears in a military uniform, but he sets the rules in Bishkek. And it's really unclear if journalists can go out and cover stories or not because they need special permission to get out. So, like I said, if you wanted to rehearse for keeping your public in tow during the time of other crisis, social unrest, perhaps, then this is a great, practice run for that.
Erica, anything to add into that?
Yes, I absolutely agree with what Bruce said. And Kazakhstan, along with Russia, are using their sophisticated CCTV infrastructure, facial recognition and license plates and recognition infrastructure to monitor the situation and to punish and capture those who are violating the rules of quarantine. This is an open message by the government that they will be using those homegrown technologies to enforce quarantine. And of course, this is a practice run. This is a leveraging technologies that have been installed to control public order. And this kind of measures are taken in the absence of a broader discussion on civil liberties. And most, to the credit of most civil society groups in Kazakhstan, they're focused on informing the population about the dangers of coronavirus and generating support for medical personnel or people who are most at risk. But the discussions of the implications, the long-term implications of using technologies to monitor the daily lives of people, mostly residents in urban areas, those discussions are not happening yet. And the most concerning part of this is potentially the crisis with coronavirus is open-ended, or at least in the foreseeable future, we don't really know when it's going to end. And that also provides the opportunity for the government to continue using and expanding technologies of surveillance of against the population and preventing mass gatherings or political activism through the very same means. And I think civil society groups in Central Asia and international NGOs need to pay more attention to these troubling trends.
So what I'm hearing is that now that the authorities have this legal tool which they have invoked to prevent the coronavirus from spreading further, they have started even more using and misusing this technology for their own benefit. Is it the case?
Yes, it's legal tools in the name of public security, public health, public order, and reinforced with the help of expansive technologies that have been installed in Kazakhstan cities just in the course of the last couple of years. So it's a very recent development in Kazakhstan.
Now, definitely, I would like to take your take on the some of the long-term implications of that a little bit later. Before that, earlier, Bruce touched upon Edwards. So the registration of tools like a computer's laptop or iPad or cell phones in Tajikistan, what do you see? Why authorities are doing this now?
Yeah, I think this has been on the cards for a number of years. There have been a number of attempts to have citizens register their SIM cards with the authorities. You know, there's already a law on the state of emergency in place that allows the government to suspend internet access to parts of the country in the case of emergency situations, that allows them to cut telephone communications, allows them to search and enter properties without a warrant. You know, so there's already this sort of legal apparatus in place in Tajikistan that was sort of codified over the past 5 years that allows the government to suspend civil liberties effectively in the case of a state of emergency. Of course, civil liberties are already sort of under threat and being cracked down upon in Tajikistan on an everyday basis, but this is a sort of intensification of that process. And I think the latest attempt to register SIM cards is just part of that longer process by which the government was preparing for this sort of situation. I don't think it envisaged that it would be in the situation of a pandemic that they may have to use these rights. It was really, it came out of the context of an insurgency and various sort of violent attacks and political violence that occurred in the country between sort of 2008 and 2012.
So, Farooq, you kind of wearing two hats today. One, as the head of the Turkmen service, of course, we are expecting you to talk about Turkmenistan, what they are doing about this. But also, because you are originally from Uzbekistan, recently one news kind of attracted my attention is they asked a local news site to take down a news piece. Now, I don't have that information in front of me, so I cannot really tell what was that about. So what kind of measures you have noticed Uzbekistan is taking? Any particular thing that you have noticed?
Uzbekistan has been quite restrictive in imposing the quarantine, and I think it is successfully trying how the measures, how quickly they can take this restrictive measures during this thanks to this quarantine situation. As far as I know, like several people were already detained and put under administrative arrest of 15 days
for violating
quarantine, and they also implemented certain restrictive measures, and it is amazing how effective they were able to do that, which means that they could apply those kind of techniques anytime, be it quarantine or be it other extreme situation.
Bruce, have you noticed anything unusual in Uzbekistan these days in regards to the measures against corona or generally in these days?
Well, I mean, they have the same general problem that Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan have in that if you are a journalist trying to cover this, of course, journalism is kind of a different animal in Uzbekistan than it is in Kyrgyzstan or Kazakhstan. But all the same, you need special permission to go out. You know, I mean, everyone's supposed to stay at home. How can you cover a story or find out any information from home? You know, you're watching state TV, so is everybody else. So you don't have a story from that. You know, and if you wanted to check up on stuff, and you know, and to be fair to some Uzbek outlets, they have gone after stories. They reported about the horrible conditions, you know, in the quarantine camps in the very early days of this crisis. But, you know, like I said, they can't just go out. Somebody can't call them and say there's a story downtown, and they can't jump in their car or walk to where this is unless they have special permission. They'll get picked up and taken down to CISO for a while. So there's restrictions still. And of course, you know, the government's quarantined several cities that you pretty much can't get in and out without special permission too. But that's true in Kazakhstan, for instance, also.
Yeah. On Kazakhstan, Erica, so before COVID-19 hit the region, there have been lots of protests were taking place, particularly in Kazakhstan. Of course, there were some also in Kyrgyzstan. So they all gone, one less headache for the authorities, I guess. So can you relate any law or measures that they have been taking recently which would keep situation like this forever? I mean, keep opposition figures and protesting activists away from the streets forever going forward.
So in addition to everything what Bruce has said about Kazakhstan, about restrictions to political protests or public gatherings, political public gatherings, it's what's important to note here is that it is really an open-ended situation. When do we know when it's safe for people to gather outside? And the authorities potentially can use the idea that gatherings are risky, specific types of gathering are risky, for a very long time, and it may set a new normal for a while. At the same time, in Kyrgyzstan, there has been a proposition by one pro-government MP to conduct yet another referendum in October this year for people to vote on whether they prefer parliamentary or presidential republic. And using this crisis and the situation where the public is mostly concerned with staying healthy and surviving the pandemic, it seems like this kind of huge referenda are really out of place, and the government and the parliament especially are using this opportunity to pass legislature that will potentially favor the incumbent president, the government, without having to deal with opposition voices or public protests against this kind of measures. So we are just, 3-4 weeks into those crisis measures in Central Asia, and already we're seeing big, ambitious political changes in the work by governments across Central Asia.
One of these things, Edward, let me bring you back here. Recently, I have witnessed President of Uzbekistan is kind of engaged in rather kind of a repeated telephone conversation with Rahmon, and we don't get much from the public statements out of this conversation, but they usually say that they have been talking about the regional issues. What's cooking up there? I mean, I guess he made the second telephone call, I guess, yesterday, within just a few days.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult to tell because obviously the transcripts are not made public. You know, I think it's, you know, it's part of Mirziyoyev's sort of image making strategy to portray himself as he has since coming to power as the sort of the new sort of regional sort of leader and the person who's making all these trips within the region, making all these phone calls and positioning himself as sort of the coordinator and the promoter of sort of Central Asian regionalism. So I think, you know, I think that could explain it from the Uzbek side. You know, and I think, you know, it's difficult to say precisely what they're talking about. We know, obviously, they've developed a relatively amicable relationship since Mirziyoyev came to power in 2016, obviously in stark contrast to the relationship, very bad relationship that Rahmon had with Karimov. So I think it's very difficult for us to say precisely what they're discussing. You would think that COVID-19 would be one of the things on the agenda, along with its sort of effects on the region.
Okay, terrific. Is there anything we missed, Bruce? It's almost the time.
I mentioned one, you know, and it kind of feeds into what probably a little bit about Tajikistan, but one of the interesting things I've noticed about this too is that at least certainly in Kazakhstan, there's a lot of civic activists, you know, who are also bloggers. And so, you know, we know that the governments have been watching people and what they write and post on Facebook and other different social networks and stuff. But a couple of the ones in Western Kazakhstan got picked up this week because they're writing about what the coronavirus situation is like where they are. The one just was filming the long lines outside the post office to collect this government payment, you know, for people who are now unemployed temporarily. They get a month's wage or, well, the equivalent of $95. So he filmed the long line and he was picked up for posting that on one of his social networks. You know, it kind of just, this process was going on anyway. But this is another situation where the government has an opportunity to crack down on these people because they're watching them. And then when they report on, we have shortages, our medical workers don't have sufficient equipment, here's the long line to get something in our country, then they, you know, all of a sudden they're detained again. And so one, it reinforces the fact the government's watching, which, you know, is never a good thing. And the other thing is, of course, you know, these gives them another misdemeanor, at least on their record. So, you know, you build these things up after a while, and it's stupid that you would give something for saying, here's a long line outside the post office. And 2 years from now, the court says, well, this is the fifth time you've been in on charges, you know, so we're going to have to put you in prison this time. So there's a lot of things that go with that. But it just, you know, it showed once again that you can't even write about what the truth is or just take a picture of what it looks like outside and post it, because the governments are so paranoid about controlling the information that's coming out of their country. What's the situation in the country, and only they can tell you that.
Yeah, let's end the discussion here with some of your future looking points.
Muhammad, I can also add that starting today in Turkmenistan, they started wide campaign to test. I don't know if they bought it or not. Maybe it was just contributed by China. They brought these testing systems, and they are now testing at schools and in some of the public organizations. And also, they are doing vaccines against TB. You know, this BCG vaccine called Bacillus Calmette-Guérin vaccine, because there was a speculation that this vaccine somehow protects against coronavirus, which is, of course, unfounded.
It's very interesting. Let's see if they are going to make public the outcome of this testing. So
they will not.
Let's see. So let's wrap up the discussion here. Some future-looking points. So, Edward, what's that you will be looking going forward, Edward, in terms of the long-term implications of the decisions that the authorities are taking or the steps that they are taking these days? So where your eyes will be going forward on how things are headed in Tajikistan? Then I would like to take all of your points about your areas of expertise. Let's start with Edward, with you.
Well, I think, you know, we talked a lot about the opportunities that this crisis presents to the ruling regimes. But I think, you know, there are also risks. You know, I think we're yet to see, as Erica says, how long this is going to last. We know it's going to be very bad for the world and very bad for the region. And in a country like Tajikistan that's completely in denial, as I said before, should coronavirus break out within the country, its public health system is not equipped to deal with that. You know, we already know that there are going to be very negative knock-on effects on the economy. You know, over a million Tajik citizens working in Russia, many of them will not be able to work there anymore. Their remittances will decrease. And so, you know, this will test the government that's deeply corrupt and kleptocratic and has been unable to deal with sort of social and economic problems within the country. Should there be this massive exogenous shock, you know, I think we could, it's very difficult to predict, but certainly it could have a destabilizing effect on Tajikistan. And of course, the government's sort of response thus far is probably only going to compound the problem. It's a response of denying that there's any problem at all.
Okay, Erica, your thoughts on some of the long-term implications of what's happening today under the context of COVID crisis and the types of laws that they are passing, the types of measures are they taking?
So similarly to what Edward said, in Kyrgyzstan and Uzbekistan, the rise of tension among especially impoverished populations in urban areas, including populations that have been cut from conducting economic activity and basically are suffering the worst impact of the stop of the the quarantine of the national economies, and how those tensions may in the medium to long term lead to more criminality, more tensions, and more even political resistance among various groups. At the same time, I think across all Central Asia, just like across the world, including in the United States, I think the politicians will use this crisis to solidify their political positions, to marginalize opponents, and try to present any improvement in the public health situation as their personal achievements, as opposed to social resilience and mobilization of grassroots activists, which is happening in Central Asia. So this dynamics will just intensify, the grabbing of power at the top, but also widening of grievances at the bottom.
That's
in Central Asia.
That's very interesting. Bruce, Erika kind of mentioned this very interesting point here. So what about your analysis? Is there any points of tension, kind of a flashpoint emerging in response to measures that are being taken currently in Central Asia? Is there anything like that for us to keep eye on going forward?
Well, a lot of people think that they're being deceived, and certainly a lot of medical workers in the region think that they're not getting adequate protection, protective clothing, adequate equipment, and that the governments aren't telling everybody exactly how bad the situation is, or where some of the breaks. Certainly in Tajikistan and Turkmenistan, is there a outbreak somewhere? And even in the countries that are reporting on it, they're not doing huge amounts of testing, so you don't know. I mean, there could end up being a lot of people who are really upset at the end of this, about that will feel they were deceived, or that again that the government used this to somehow further marginalize them. And let's not forget for one thing that Kyrgyzstan still has parliamentary elections planned. Now, Tajikistan has a presidential election, but that's not a very controversial deal. It's not even a real competition, right? But Kyrgyzstan has what should be like a fascinating parliamentary election, because two biggest parties in parliament really don't exist anymore outside of parliament. They're not cohesive anyway. So how long is the government going to hold on to quarantine measures? And would they choose to hold if the health situation is not good, if the virus is still spreading, would they choose to hold parliamentary elections knowing that it could lead to a further outbreak? Probably not. But then if they delay it, at whose expense is the delay? Because some parties, maybe a couple months extra down the road, will have a stronger hand in the campaigning, and some a weaker one.
Right. Okay, Farooq, very briefly, we are way out of time. So where your eyes will be going forward to look where we are headed with this in countries that you closely follow?
Yeah, in Turkmenistan, it is very likely that Turkmenistan will keep claiming that they don't have any coronavirus. They still are warning people against discussing it. They even, when using the WHO recommendations against coronavirus, they say WHO recommendations against acute respiratory diseases. Even there they don't pronounce it. So they're going to test people, and a lot of people are going to be locked down on quarantine zones. Not at home in Turkmenistan, they don't do that. They will be taken to quarantine zones, and I guess there will be more quarantine zones to the ones that, in addition to ones that exist at the moment. So there will be more restrictions, and regions are already separated between each other. All the major roads are closed, and they will probably remain closed in the coming month or two.
Yeah, very sad. Okay, with this, unfortunately, we have to end the discussion here. Thank you very much, Dr. Erika Marat, Associate Professor of the National Defense University and the author of The Politics of Police Reform. Dr. Edward Lehman, Assistant Professor at the Daniel Morgan Graduate School. Farooq Yusufi, the Director of Ready Free or Pre-Do Liberty's Turkmen Service. Bruce Panier, the Editor of Ready Free or Pre-Do Liberty's Central Asia Blog. Kishlok Owazi, thank you, colleagues, for your time and thoughts today. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, Ready for Pre-Do Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast. And let's see if we can tape the podcast next week, given the situation in Washington, D.C. The health officials here, they say that this city might be the next hot spot. So we will continue to monitor the situation. In the meantime, please stay safe. Thank you very much.